Accession number 28672, Mr. Tony Bradbury, Reel 2. Now, we were talking about your time back in Hampstead from the summer of 1940. Could you comment a bit about the blackout arrangements, either in your own house or generally? You know, because you'd be a delivery boy out early in the morning, late at night, sometimes, I presume. What effect did the blackout have?
Well, there were a large number of people who seemed to appear from nowhere wearing tin hats with ARP on them. And they were very officious, really. That light out. The faintest glimmer of a torch, something like this, they'd jump on you from nowhere, really. And they were very keen to make sure that no lights were seen.
Now, how did your mother do it, or your family do it in your house? What arrangements were there?
Well, when we finally started living in the house full-time again, my mother used to draw the curtains, and there was a very zealous ARP warden used to come round and check that no chink of light was escaping through the curtains, something like this. And if there was a chink of light showing, he'd knock at the door and say, "You've got a light showing through that chink of curtain." And you'd have to do something about it, you see. And if you were out in an air raid, if I'm cycling round sometimes in September 40 and delivering bread, and sometimes an air raid would start. And from nowhere, apparently, it seemed to me that someone would jump out and say, "Take shelter, take shelter."
Now, what were the air raids like? They started in September, the London Blitz. What were those air raids like? Can you give us people don't understand what they were like now. They can't understand, obviously, what it was like. They weren't there.
Well, my experience, I suppose, was coloured by what I might term the insensitivity of youth. And I thought it very exciting. Big bangs, aircraft flying about overhead all over the place, very exciting, and frankly, I didn't mind it a bit.
You weren't scared at all, then?
No, because I was so interested in what was going on I didn't seem to be scared. I should have been, I suppose. I would be now, but I wasn't then. My father and mother were, quite rightly. And they couldn't understand why I wasn't. Because I said to my mother after about 10 days of going down the tube, "I'm not going to have this anymore. I'm going to stay at home. You go down the tube if you want." Of course, that led to a family bust up. But she went and father went down the tube. And I stayed upstairs, stayed at home upstairs.
You didn't even go to the street one. You just stayed at home.
I just stayed at home. I went to the street one with them when they finally gave up the tube and went into the street shelter. But after a bit, I never went there. They used to stay in the street shelter. And I used to stay at home.
Now, was there much bombing in the Hampstead area? Or what could you see? I mean, you've got an ideal viewing platform up there for what's happening. What could you see?
Well, my most vivid impression was the night of September the 7th, 1940, when they started the full-scale night raids on London. And I went on Hampstead Heath. I went up Parliament Hill, where you could get a magnificent view of London right the way down to Tilbury, really. You could see Tower Bridge, Westminster Abbey, Houses of Parliament, St Paul's Cathedral. You can see the whole of London stretched out before you, much more than you can now when there's so many high buildings put up. And I must say that I was so fascinated by what I saw that I didn't go home till 3 o'clock in the morning.
Now, what could you see? I know it's difficult to describe something, but...
Well, there were a large number of soldiers up there who had obviously been heaved out of Dunkirk. And they were very virulent about the German aircraft dropping bombs on London. We could see explosions all over the place. There'd be a downfall of bombs, and then there'd be a fire breakout when they dropped incendiaries. And it looked to me as though London was on fire. Of course it wasn't, but it looked at that time as though London was all ablaze. And of course I realise now that my view was somewhat exaggerated.
Was there an anti-aircraft battery up on in Amsterdam? I think there used to be, but I'm not sure whether there was in the
Not at that time. There was one further back on the heath, near a place near a home called the Priors. And they had a barrage balloon there as well, which was put there just before the war broke out.
Did you have much to do with that anti-aircraft barrier? Battery, or I mean, were you took an interest in it?
No, well, I never took an active interest, but I was quite interested to listen to the big bangs and all the rest of it.
Any bombs land in Hampstead at all?
Or? Yeah, quite a few. The local hospital, not far away, New End Hospital, got bombed, and the boiler house was hit. That was about 150 yards away from home, I suppose. Later on in the Blitz, my bedroom windows got imploded. They got sucked out as opposed to being pushed in. But generally speaking, Hampstead got away with it fairly lightly. Not compared to other places that I ventured to see in my off-duty moments, delivering bread. I used to cycle as far as Silvertown, places like that, and there I could see really what bombing was like. It was very whole streets demolished.
Now, what's the next thing you remember? How long were you doing this job as a delivery boy, or did you get into engineering? What happened?
Well, I finally got a job in an engineering factory. In November 40.
Now, which engineering factory?
What was Ernest Moyes in Camden Town.
And what was it making?
Well, all sorts of bits and pieces. They used to make a lot of photographic gear before the war.
So light engineering?
Light engineering, yes.
And what were you doing in the factory?
Well, learning how to fit, a bit of lathe work, all this sort of thing.
Were you actually an apprentice, or were you just a general?
The apprenticeships seemed to have gone by the board by then, and a lot of the older hands who worked there for many years, they didn't like the idea of people coming in with no training. They liked to see apprenticeships because this is what they're always accustomed to. So a large number of them were a bit anti. But they'd help you out, but they weren't particularly friendly. But a lot of the younger people were quite good.
Yeah. So tell me a bit about the work you do. They had been making photographic equipment. What were they making during the actual war or when you worked for them?
Well, it seemed to be that they were making in the early part of the war mainly photographic equipment.
Oh, they were still doing that?
They're still doing that, yes. I think they were gradually changing over to making war equipment, but it wasn't very much. And by the time I got done about 6 months there, done a bit of lathe work and general engineering, you know, messing about in general, really, I got the offer of another job, better paid, at a factory not very far away that was actually engaged in making stuff for the war.
What were they making?
Well, one of the things they made were spare parts for stain guns, and that was their main occupation. But I was fortunate enough to have a bit of a shall we say a better training, because they put me on screw cutting and all this sort of thing. And when they wanted to do any screw cutting, I seemed to be quite good at working out the trade of gears on the old-fashioned lathes for for making the various pitches of thread. So I did quite a bit of screw cutting there.
Did you enjoy the work?
Yeah, quite good.
And reasonably paid?
Not bad. I was getting towards the end of my time there, but before I joined the Navy, I was getting £6 a week. Good money.
That's a lot, though.
Yes, it was, yes.
Now, what were you doing for recreations? We're quite interested in this. I mean, you're only young. If you're there till 43, you're 16, 17, 18, you know.
Yes.
What did you do for amusement in the evenings?
Well, we used to do about 10 hours a day, you see, which was for a chap my age, I suppose, a bit tiring. And I used to cycle from Hampstead to near to King's Cross, where this factory was. And by the time I cycled back home, by this time the Blitz was over, of course. But so I cycled back home, and by that time, I really didn't want anything to do with sport or anything like that. I just wanted to go to bed and have a kip, really.
You didn't go to the pub or the cinema or dances?
No.
Now, what's the next thing that happens then? Anything else happened during the next couple of years?
Well, when I was 16, I became reasonably proficient at lathe work and general fitting and all this sort of thing. So I said to my father, I'd like to join the Navy. And he was most indignant. He says, you will not join the Navy until I can't stop you. That was his attitude towards it. Because after his experiences after the First World War, he was not at all enamoured of the Second World War. So he said, you will not join the Navy until you're 18, when I can no longer stop you. So I had another row with him. But there we are. We carried on. And he didn't believe in the war at all. I'll be frank about that. And
what did he think then? I mean, was he just anti-war?
He was anti-war. He was very much against the war with Germany to begin with.
Why?
Well, because he thought that we'd have done better if Ribbentrop had succeeded in his ambassadorship over here and got us to have an alliance with Germany. That was his attitude. And when we didn't get that, and we went in, more or less said we'd support France if they got attacked, I don't think he was very pleased. But he never took any active steps against the war. He just wanted as little to do with it as possible. And he didn't understand why I wanted to join up after what he told me about the First World War. But I think his mainspring was that he was very anti-war in general.
Now, this obviously wasn't shared by you. So what happened then? You couldn't join at 16.
I couldn't join at 16, so I stuck it out, carried on working at this firm until I was 18, and then joined the Navy.
Now, how did you go about joining the Navy? Did you wait to be called up, or did you volunteer?
I had to wait to be called up, because at that time they wouldn't let you join because of the nature of the work, you see. Because I was doing this work in an engineering firm, they said you've got to wait to be called up.
Now, did you actually have reserved occupation status or not?
I did, yes.
Now, tell me about that. I mean, what did that mean? I mean, how are you going to get out of that?
It was essentially, well, what I did, I'll be quite frank about it, I made myself a bloody nuisance. That was what I did.
How?
Well, by being cheeky to the boss, being cheeky to his son, who was also running the firm. When they wanted to put me on making bits for Sengards, I said, no, I'd rather carry on screw cutting, this sort of thing. So in the end, after about a couple of months, they got fed up with this. And then they said to the chap from the Ministry of Labour, who was the sort of arbitrator, I think this chap would do better in the Navy. So, like a fool, really, I dropped from £6 a week to £28.
Now, how did you go about joining the Navy?
Well, I went, they said...
They called you up. What was the call-up procedure?
Well, I got a letter saying, report to the... report to the medical centre at King's Cross, where you'll have a medical examination. Well, I did that.
What was the medical like? How strict? Or
not very strict, actually. By that time of the war, they were May, June 43, they were beginning to take the bottom of the barrel, I think. They wanted people from anywhere they could get them. So I did have a very strict medical, but they passed me A1. I said, right, well, go home, carry on working, and in time we'll notify you about what service you're going to join, you see. Well,
you weren't given a choice then?
Well, I wasn't given no choice. I said it's a matter of what was most needed at the time, I suppose, in retrospect.
Had you told them you wanted to be in the RN?
Yeah, I told them that.
But
yes.
They told you you might not get it?
Yeah. Yes, I said you might have joined the army. So I just waited on for a little longer. And then in September 43, my papers arrived. Joined the Navy at Warrington on such and such a date, 17th of September, I believe.
And how did your father react to that? I mean, had he...
Well, once he realised that it was all inevitable, that I was going anyway, he sort of changed his attitude. He seemed quite proud, funny enough. And the funny thing about it was, despite his anti-war tendencies, when the German bombers were flying overhead in the period from September 40 to May 41, he used to listen to the aircraft shells going up and hit the buggers, he'd say, you know, things like that. But he was quite pleased that... I think he was quite pleased that I joined, actually. I think that his... by that time... His attitude was changing a bit, and at least he was quite pleased to think that one of his sons was going in the Navy.
So, you have to go to Warrington. Is this Warrington or Padgate?
No, I went to Warrington.
Tell me about what was it you were going to Warrington? What was happening there?
Well, in retrospect, to make a long story out of a short one. I found out later that some far-sighted character or characters in the Admiralty had decided that it would be a good idea to follow the American example and have mobile operational naval air bases to jump from island to island servicing aircraft. So I've never actually seen this in writing, but I think this was the idea, because I went to Warrington.
Now, who were you joining there?
I joined Gosling 1. That was the main camp.
Was it HMS Gosling?
HMS Gosling, yes. And it was based on five...
And that's a shore station.
It was obviously a stone frigate, actually. Stone frigate.
And it's actually in Warrington, or just...
No, it was outside Warrington. It was near Earlham. No, I'm sorry. I went to Gosling 1 first of all.
And that's at Warrington?
And that was near Warrington, yes.
You don't know what... Well, Warrington will do.
Yes.
Now, you got there in September.
I got there in September.
Now, you're arriving essentially as a civilian. You've got no uniform, no nothing. Even the journey down, you presume you travelled about before. What do you remember about your reception when you first get there as a civilian?
Well, again, to go back a bit, funnily enough, I'd gone up on the train from King's Cross to Warrington, and there were several sailors on there who had taken part in a recent hit-and-run raid on the French coast. And I got talking to them, and they were quite sympathetic, you know, silly bugger sort of thing. And one said to me, oh, you'll be all right, he said, you'll like it there, you'll like it in the Navy. And so he was quite pally. So got off the train and we waited there for a bit till some other trains came into Warrington, till some other people joined, until we got a lorry load. There was a leading seaman who drove the lorry. We all piled into this lorry and went off to Cosling One. When we arrived there, we sort of roughly sorted out in just fairly short order with, we take away all the civilian clothes and send them home to your parents. Here's your uniforms.
Now, tell us what we were kitted out with.
Well,
if you can remember exactly.
Two suits of blue, three collars, two caps. We got two of everything. Two boots, heavy boots. What was known as scapa scantis, in other words, these long jean things. We got two suits of those. A white front, two white fronts. That was about the kit.
And what else? Could you get a hammock or were they not?
No, we had, because what had happened, they'd taken over, to start this thing going, the Admiralty had taken over some ex-munition workers' accommodation, and they were in five different camps. And Gosling 1 was the reception camp, and Goslings 2, 3, 4 and 5, they were outlying places from Gosling 1.
Now, what was the actual unit called? It was called HMS Gosling, but did it have a name like School of...
Nothing like that.
Just HMS Gosling.
Security. Just HMS Gosling.
Right. Now, so you're kitted out, and what about your accommodation? What were you accommodated in?
Well, the same old thing that we'd experienced in the in the tube stations, really. Just two-tier bunks in cubicles that had been vacated sometime before by the munition workers.
So, it wasn't actually homes, it was in barracks, was it? Or?
Oh, yes.
Huts or what?
Well, just sort of pretty rough breeze block, I suppose, buildings, quite rudimentary. No heating really. Bathrooms, you've got a certain amount of gear, you know, that to keep you clean, sort of thing. And we used to live in these, in Gosling 1 and later in Gosling 5, we used to live in these very crude, sort of roughly put up buildings, which had nothing really except just bunks in them.
Now let's start looking at your training. If we just look at a typical day, it sort of picks up a lot of things off that, conditions and training. Now, well, how would your day start at Gosling 1?
Well, after Gosling 1, the first morning after we got there, we got a talk by the captain.
And what did he tell you?
He told us not very much, really, except I think if you keep your nose clean, don't get into any trouble. His name is Captain Freyberg, by the way, and he was the brother of Lieutenant General Freyberg, who was, I think, in command of a New Zealand division in the Second World War out in the Western Desert. And he was his brother, and he was quite a nice bloke, really. We didn't see much of him, because he was always wandering around between the different camps and that. And he roughly gave us a welcoming speech the first morning and said, well, we're going to sort you out into your various classes, and you lot that have arrived yesterday are going to go to Gosling 5. And when we got to Gosling 5, it was very, very little different from Gosling 1.
So it was literally, you just got kitted out in a reception speech. That's all you spent at 1?
Yeah, that's all I spent at 1, yes. And just this reception speech, and then we went off to Gosling 5. And there we were met by the officer in charge of the course, who said, I'm going to introduce you to your instructor, who's a leading seaman, and he'd been in the Navy a very long time, because, as I'll tell you later, I think he was at the Battle of Jutland under the then Captain Dudley Pound on the battleship Colossus. So he was a very nice bloke, actually. Very stern if you went put a foot wrong, but he was not the sort of bloke to victimise any particular person, in contrast to some of the other instructors. We were very lucky to have him, really, in our class, because some of the earlier classes, who had been there 2 or 3 weeks, were under people who had come there for a so-called rest after having served on convoys for God knows how long. And some of them were, well, I think some of them were mental, really.
We'll come back to that.
Yeah.
So what course were you on? I mean,
well, a general induction course, I suppose.
Now, so take us through a typical day at Gosling 5.
Well, the first thing they did was take away our civilian gas masks and issue us with service gas masks. Then the class instructor said, I need somebody to be in charge of the class while I'm not there. So he looked around and he picked on the oldest bloke there. He seemed very old to me. He was about 35. And he said, you are the class instructor. And his name, fortunately for me, he came from an area that's of Bedfordshire that was where the farm was, and the farmer had been a friend of my father's in the Hertfordshire Yeomanry out in Egypt. So from the start we exchanged reminiscences, and after that we got on very well together, and I was very lucky to have such a good course instructor, and also such a good bloke, really, in charge of the class, because he looked after me like a father.
And how did your day start then?
Well, we used to get up about 6:30, quick ablutions, breakfast at about 7.
Now, let's talk about food generally. This is probably your first experience of institutional food on that scale.
Yes.
What did you think of the food rations they served you?
Not bad. In fact, they were better than we got at home, really. I thought, this is good, you know, better food than in civilian life.
But enough of it?
Oh yeah, I was never hungry.
And well presented and turned out?
Well, on the whole, yes. There were one or two times when the canteen staff fell over, but generally speaking, there was rather a lot of Swede. We used to get Swede, or seemed to be a Lancashire crop that was in great strength up there, really. And we used to get Swede with nearly every dinner time, and sometimes in the evenings. But apart from that, it wasn't bad. It wasn't badly cooked.
Now, what would you do after your breakfast?
Well, we'd then have to go round and clean up our quarters.
Now, how much tidying and cleaning is this? What level of spick and spanness?
Fold the blankets, put your pillow on top. All the blankets have to be folded neatly. Put your pillow on top. Sweep out your quarters. And make your cubicle, which I share with two others, quite in reasonable condition. And got yourself looking reasonably clean and tidy. And then went on divisions.